From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as you prepare for the holiday, we spend time with the singer Sinatra once called the best in the business, Tony Bennett. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life. Tony Bennett coming up on Fresh Air.
I'm stepping out with my baby. Can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. It's for sure, not for maybe, that I'm all dressed up tonight. Stepping out with my honey, can't be bad, feels so good. Never felt quite so sunny, and I keep on knocking wood. There'll be smooth sailing, cause I'm trimming my sails. With my top hat, and my white tie, and my tails. Stepping out with my baby, can't go wrong, cause I'm in right.
First the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frank Sinatra once called Tony Bennett the best singer in the business, and who am I to quarrel with that? Now with Sinatra gone, we cherish Bennett even more. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life, which was written with Will Friedwald, the author of Sinatra, The Song Is You. Tony Bennett also has a new CD called The Playground, featuring songs geared to kids and their parents. Let's start with a song from it, written by Walter Donaldson. This is My Mom.
I've got one real friend, more than a friend I find. The way I feel, friend, sees all of this heart of mine. I'm all for her, I know. She'll always be for me. I'm on my way, friend, I'm going home to see my mom. I love her. My mom, you'd love her. Wouldn't love her, my mom. That sweet somebody thinks I'm somebody. My pal, my buddy, my mom.
Tony Bennett, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
That's a nice song, My Mom. I've never heard it before. It's by Walter Donaldson, who also wrote At Sundown and Little White Lies, Love Me or Leave Me, Yes Sir, That's My Baby, My Blue Heaven. You say in your book that your father used to sing this song?
Yeah, he sang it to my brother and myself made us, even fall in love more with our mother. And he was just a wonderful, sweet father. He always sang that song, and to this day, my brother and I remember it and remember it as our favorite song.
Did your father sing a lot?
He did. In Calabria, he had a reputation for singing on the top of a mountain, and the whole valley would hear it. And they enjoyed him so much.
What was his style of singing? Was it operatic or pop?
It was opera. Yes, it was opera. And my brother inherited that side of him, and was at 14 years old. He was known as the Little Caruso and sang in the Metropolitan Opera, solo spots, and... So that's our whole, it was a great way to start thinking about music, to start right with the greatest music of all, which is opera.
Your father died at the age of 41. How old were you?
I was 10 years old.
Did you have to go out early and support the family after his death, or help support the family?
Well, really, yes. That's the one thing I had on my mind. It was because of my mom, and I wanted to make sure she was working so hard, and I really felt for her all the time, and felt that I wanted to go, you know, just get any kind of job to help her out.
So you dropped out of high school, I think, to get work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, well, I worked during high school, and I became a singing waiter toward the end of the. I didn't finish high school, so I became a singing waiter in Astoria, Long Island, and found that out of all the jobs, I didn't like any job I had, and it was the only job that I said, if I have to do this the rest of my life, I'll be happy doing that.
Close, huh?
Yeah.
It sounds like you really liked high school, even though you had to drop out. You went to the High School of Industrial Arts in New York.
I loved it. It was so, you know, it was a school that was set up by President Roosevelt to just then Mayor LaGuardia to help children get an occupation. And it was a wonderful school because they taught you the techniques of every form of art, and stained glass windows, and silkscreen, and photography, painting, cartooning. It was just wonderful. And they also had this very advanced approach, alternative approach of saying you don't have to come to school. I couldn't believe that after public school and junior high school. They said, you don't have to come to school as long as you stay out. If you stay out 5 days, just come back with 5 days' work of painting, and you don't have to attend school. Well, that automatically made me not want to miss a day. So we had great teachers, and it was a wonderful experience.
And, of course, you still paint. When you were in high mm-hmm. school, did you think you would be a professional painter or singer?
Well, there was one teacher, Mr. Sonberg, who was in the music department of the school, and he said, you really have an exceptional voice, and you should really carry on as an entertainer. And he got the art teachers upset with him. But I took his advice, and it's been a split road ever since. I paint and sing, and that's become my life.
My guest is Tony Bennett, and he has a new memoir, which is called The Good Life. You were drafted toward the end of World War II, and after basic training, you were sent to the front lines. Where were you sent?
I was sent as a replacement after the Battle of the Bulge, days after the Battle of the Bulge, and it was very traumatic. I really, it really affected my whole life because I couldn't believe the deportment of the soldiers that were on the Battle of the Bulge. It was just tragic to see how it affected their lives, to see all that killing and insanity. It was something that I'll never forget, and it changed my life.
Were there still bodies from the battle lying all around when you got there?
Yes.
You point out that more than half of the replacement soldiers became casualties within their first 3 days on the front lines, in part because they were so underprepared and the soldiers who were there were so exhausted that they couldn't help in training them much. Did you feel very underprepared for what you faced?
Well, I couldn't believe what I faced. I mean, it was a complete insanity, it was the lower depths, the height of the lower depths, to see the mood and the psyche of the soldiers that came out of the Battle of the Bulge, and how the soldiers that had died that were their friends, and it was very morbid. It was quite tragic.
Did you have any close calls yourself?
I did, yes.
As punishment for bringing a black friend to a Thanksgiving dinner while the army was still segregated, you were given the assignment of reburying the dead, moving them from mass graves to individual ones. How did you protect yourself emotionally and physically from this contact with the dead?
Well, I mean, it was really a crack-up for me. I mean, I just couldn't believe that I was placed there, and it's affected my life to this day. I just couldn't believe it. And there's a Major Lefkowitz that was nice enough to hear about my problem and pulled me right out and made me a music librarian for the American Forces Network. It was really... Talk about rainbows after a great storm, and it changed my... I just decided to go into the music business for the rest of my life.
While you were at the front lines during World War II, Bob Hope did a show that you got to see, and you say that had an enormous impact on you, going from the front lines to seeing this terrific show. Do you remember what songs he sang or what jokes he told?
Well, I remember Thanks for the Memory, his theme song. But more than that, you had Jane Russell on the show and Les Brown's band and the GIs, and I was one of them. And we couldn't believe that he was so wonderful to us, and what a memorable show. And he took us off the line. I mean, that was really... I always say that he actually saved my life, because we had 88 bombs coming at us, you know, and... And all of a sudden they said, you're going back, retreating. So I thought we were retreating, and found out that it was just a release and a relief for us to just get a second win before we went back again. And he was just, I mean, I can't tell you that how many soldiers will never forget Bob Hope for what he did for them.
I know you got to work with Bob Hope. Did you tour with him during wartime at any point?
No, it was after the war. And for about 5 years, I was just looking around for work. And then Pearl Bailey heard me down in Greenwich Village, and she was working in the club, the Greenwich Village Inn, and heard me rehearsing in the afternoon. And she told the owner, if you don't have him on the show, I'm not coming in here. And she got me started there. And then he came down... From the Paramount Theater, he came down to hear Pearl and saw me on the show and got a big kick out of it and said, come on, you're coming up to the Paramount, and changed my name from Anthony Dominic Benedetto to Tony Bennett.
Bob Hope changed it?
Yep. He said, let's Americanize you. We'll call you Tony Bennett. So that was a thrill. I've had that name ever since. And when I paint, it's Benedetto, my family name, and when I perform, it's Tony Bennett.
What do you think you learned from Bob Hope in terms of show business?
Well, it's a nice Jewish expression, you know, show him you like him. You know, he always told me to, when you come out on the stage, you know, just make sure that you you show the people that you enjoy being there and you want to entertain them and show them your enthusiasm.
How do you do that?
You psych yourself out. And you just do it. After a while, it becomes, you realize that it's the right way, and then you really mean it.
My guest is Tony Bennett. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tony Bennett is my guest, and he has a new memoir called The Good Life. I'm going to ask you to choose something from your first round of Columbia Records. You know, you left them and then came back, and you're with Columbia again. But choose something from the first time you were with Columbia that you particularly like and that you think holds up really well.
Well, you might... I introduced a song called Blue Velvet, and you might like to hear that.
It's funny, most people will know that from the Bobby Vinton recording.
Yeah, well, that's once again the commercial side of it, because it has a terrible background and it's really it's not recorded well. There's a friend of mine that was way ahead of time. He had a record company called Horrible Records. He said, if it's horrible, it's bound to be a hit.
So you know, you think the Bobby Vinton version wasn't recorded well?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
It's not my opinion.
Okay.
It's a fact.
And so your version precedes his.
Yeah, but it still sold a lot of records.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's what's so funny. When I meet a rock star, you know, they really make $500 million or something. And I do very well. I mean, I'm, you know, financially comfortable and everything. But they look at me like I'm on welfare. They'll say things like, are you still singing? Are you still singing, Mr. Bennett? And I say, why are you calling Mr. Bennett? You're as old as I am.
Okay, well, let's hear Blue Velvet. This is Tony Bennett.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night, softer than satin was the light from the stars. She wore bluer than velvet were her eyes, warmer than May her tender sighs. Love was ours, ours, a love I held tightly, feeling the rapture grow. Like a flame burning brightly. But when she left, gone was the glow of blue velvet.
That's Tony Bennett, and he has a new memoir, which is called The Good Life. Now, you're back with Columbia Records, and you even own your early masters now, which must be very nice. Not all artists get to do that.
Oh, it's wonderful. I could thank my son for that. In the last 17 years, he's managed me, and he's brilliant. He knows what he's doing, and he's done a great job for me. Just changed my whole career around.
When you first signed to Columbia Records, this was in the early 1950s, Frank Sinatra was still on the label, and he and Mitch Miller occasionally had feuds about repertoire. Did you get to know Frank Sinatra during that period? Did you see yourselves as friends or as rivals?
No, I didn't know him at all at that time. But then I started getting one hit after another. I was the Madonna of my day. And what happened was I was very frightened. I was a young artist, and I got this wonderful opportunity. Perry Como had me do a summer replacement and left me with a kind of a bare stage in the summer replacement. They cut the budget away from his elaborate budget that he had and left me kind of with a bare stage on CBS. And I was very frightened about how to perform on television. Well, I just took a deep breath, and Sinatra was at the Paramount Theater with a reunion with Tommy Dorsey. And I said, I'm going to go backstage and talk to him. And I was warned, look out, he could be pretty tough. So I said, no, but I love the way he sings, and I love him personally as a fan. I'm just going to go up and talk to him. Found out that it was just the opposite of what everybody said about him. He was just wonderful to me, and sat me right down in his dressing room and gave me some wonderful advice about not worrying about being nervous. Because he said the public likes that. He said if you don't care, he said, why should the audience care? He said if you're nervous, they're going to see that you care, so they're going to root for you. And the more they root for you, the more you'll give back to them. He said it'll just be fine, and it was wonderful advice. And then he said this very same thing I was always kind of fighting for, and he said, don't ever do silly songs. Stay away from silly songs. Do very well written songs by great composers. Well, that advice was fantastic, because it's really sustained me for 45 years now.
You recently did a tribute album to Sinatra called Perfectly Frank, and mm-hmm. I thought this would be a good time to play something from that. I thought we'd hear I Fall in Love Too Easily. Do you want to say anything about this song or about recording the album before we hear it?
Well, that was the song that made everybody, men and women, fall in love with Frank Sinatra. That was the first movie he was in, and it was a lovely song that was my favorite period of Sinatra anyway. It was the most musical, and it was the height of American popular music. I don't think it'll ever be replaced. It was he had this gorgeous gift. He was the equivalent in popular music to DiStefano in opera. He had this great musicality in his voice that was just natural and gifted. It was a golden voice, and his recording of that really proves how wonderful he sang.
Well, this is Tony Bennett singing I Fall in Love Too Easily.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last. My heart should be well schooled, 'cause I've been fooled in the past, and still I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I've been fooled in the past, and still I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too.
Tony Bennett will be back in the second half of the show. His new autobiography is called The Good Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music. Available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tony Bennett talks about Frank Sinatra, Duke Ellington, and Bill Evans. We're listening to a recording by Bennett's longtime pianist, Ralph Sharon. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tony Bennett. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life. In writing about his own life, he writes about some of the singers and musicians he's known and worked with. Do you feel that you learned things about singing from listening to Sinatra?
Well, you know, if you listen to one, it's thievery, but if you listen to everybody, it's research. So I listen to Sinatra, I listen to Bing Crosby, I listen to Louis Armstrong. You know, it's a lot of girl singers taught me how to sing. Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Carmen McRae, they're all wonderful stylists and they do great things with intimate singing, the art of intimate singing.
You were not only a big fan of Sinatra's, he was a big fan of yours. And a much-quoted now Life magazine article from April of 1965, he said, "For my money, Tony Bennett is the best singer in the business. He excites me when I watch him. He moves me. He's the singer who gets across what the composer has in mind and probably a little bit more." It strikes me, though, that you lived your lives very differently, at least from my perspective, just kind of watching it. Looks like you lived your lives pretty differently. Frank Sinatra was much more in the limelight. There was the Rat Pack. He had a reputation as being much more temperamental and so on. And I'm wondering if you feel like you learned anything by watching him live his life in terms of the effect of that public life on him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've had a very interesting relationship with Sinatra. It's now that he's gone, I think about it and I realize, boy, that was really different because we were never really that close. The Rat Pack was a lot closer to him. I lived on the East Coast most of the time and he was out on the West Coast and making films and doing nightclubs in Vegas mostly. But yet I'd go see him a lot and whenever I saw him, it was wonderful and it was always an uppie to be around him. He was had so much fun. Nobody ever had more fun than Frank Sinatra, believe me. But then there would always be these things that it would always surprise me because when I first met Orson Welles backstage at the Radio City at the Night of 100 Stars, he said, you know, he says, I go to every one of Sinatra's parties and he always plays your records. You know, things like that. I would always be shocked say, you're kidding. He said, no, that's true. And then I realized, looking back, that every season, Sinatra would always change quite a few numbers in his performance every season. He would always say something about me that was complimentary and encouraging for the public to go see me perform somewhere. He would always turn a phrase or say it a different way, but each season, he would say something the whole season that would either mention the song that I recorded or say, you got to see this guy, Bennett, he's really cooking right now. He'd say something in the audience that would promote the public to come and see me. So he was he really affected my career because his huge fan clubs, they would all say, let's see what Sinatra's talking about. And he would really fill the seats for me. And he's always been a great friend right through the years. And then one night, just recently before he died, the last performance he gave at Radio City, I was sitting in the audience and he said, this is my friend. He says, he's my best friend, not only in show business, but my best friend, period. And he had me stand up and take a bow in Radio City. And that really moved me. That was something.
It strikes me you were always a more kind of accessible performer than Sinatra. I don't mean musically, but in terms of just contact with you. I mean, Sinatra wouldn't have done a radio interview, I don't think, unless maybe with Sid Mark, who does the Sinatra show. Sinatra
right.
Probably couldn't even have played Carnegie Hall because he had to play stadiums.
That was later. He did play Carnegie Hall, and when he did, it was magnificent. I saw him. In fact, it was the best concert I ever saw in my life for a popular singer. And it was at Carnegie Hall with a tremendous orchestra of about 80 musicians and everybody in tails. And it was, it was a magnificent evening. But I know exactly what you're saying. But you see, that was in those days, it was the film star attitude, you know, you had to appear unattainable.
Yes, I mean, in other words, I think you put your finger on it. You had to appear unattainable, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's almost like, you know, in show business, everything's kind of a game. Each individual plays it a different way. And I liked Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald in the sense that they were truly humble, and they were accessible to the fans. I learned a long time ago. I play Britain for the last 50 years now, and there are just lines of fans at the end of the performance that in a double row, and they just want my autograph, and I just stay there and sign every autograph. I mean, I just think it's, you know, if they like me, I'm going to like them.
I want to pause here for some more music, and I think every time you've ever done Fresh Air, I've managed to play something from one of the Tony Bennett, Bill Evans records. They're such extraordinary records.
And, thank you.
So I thought this time around we'd play Some Other Time.
Oh, good.
So let's hear that, and then we'll talk a little bit.
Where has the time all gone to? Haven't done half the things we want to. Oh, we'll catch up some other time. This day was just a token. Too many words are still unspoken. Oh, we'll catch up some other time. Just when the fun is starting, comes the time for partying. But let's be glad for what we've had and what's to come. There's so much more embracing still to be done, but time is racing. Oh, we'll catch up some other time.
That's Tony Bennett and Bill Evans, and my guest is Tony Bennett. He has a new memoir, which is called The Good Life. In your memoir, you write a little bit about doing your two records with Bill Evans, and you loved working with him, and God, these records are extraordinary. You see, the problem, though, that you saw was the depressing thing was watching how Bill Evans' drug habit interfered with his life. Did it interfere with his music, too, do you think? Did you feel it getting in the way at all of rehearsals or whatever?
Oh, no. It didn't affect him at all in any way. He went past that. He hated being addicted. He hated it. I told him, I said, I guess you didn't get enough love when you were young. He said, oh, love. He said, I wish someone would have hit me and knocked me out when the first time I took a needle. He said that was the worst thing that ever happened to me, and he was very, very sick. At the end of his life, I can't tell you how hard it was. It was just absolutely horrid. He just would blow up, and at the end of a performance, he would play everything, and he would just blow up, and it was just filled up with water and fluid, and he'd have to lay down in the prone position and just wait until it all subsided. And I'll never forget that one night I was in a small little town somewhere, and I got this call from Bill Evans, it was 6 months before he died, and he said, "Tony," he said, "just think truth and beauty," he said, "and just forget the rest." That was his last words to me.
Why do you think he said that?
Because he believed that that's the right way. He believed that that's what music's about. He believed that that's the road to correct music and correct living, truth and beauty. You know, that's what life is all about.
And you think he was able to keep in touch with that musically even when he was really sick?
Oh, he went past the sickness. He just had to do it. He had this, it was compulsive about just playing better and better and better. I mean, it was amazing, the intensity. He was a genius at the, he bridged the gap. I mean, before, the classical music always wanted to play jazz, and they couldn't quite make it. And jazz artists wanted to play classical, and they couldn't quite make it. He found a way to bridge the gap. He was able to swing and still had classical background. So that's when people like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, when they heard him playing, they said, "God, I have to sing with this guy." They couldn't believe what they were listening to. The resolvements in the music that he was playing was so fantastic. They had never heard anything like that. He was that good.
My guest is Tony Bennett. His new autobiography is called The Good Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tony Bennett. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life. I want to ask you about Duke Ellington. It seems like you had a really nice relationship with him. You say that he used to send you flowers after he wrote a new song.
Yeah, every time he wrote a new song, he sent me flowers.
Why did he do that?
Well, because he was a gentleman. It's old-fashioned, but it was correct. He was just courteous to people that he liked.
Did he want you to sing the song? Is that why he sent them to you? I'm sure he didn't send flowers to everyone he knew after he wrote a song.
No, he liked me, and we were close. Our families were close, and he was another master, great master, and it's funny, people don't realize it, but there are more recordings of his music than the Beatles. Every musician, everywhere in the world, wherever I go, I'll go into some cabaret somewhere, or I'll listen to a radio in Denmark or Sweden or Belgium, and you'll hear a Duke Ellington song. Every musician just loves Duke Ellington.
Would you choose an Ellington song that you recorded that you'd like us to play?
Solitude is fine.
Good, let's hear that. And this is Tony Bennett.
In my solitude, you haunt. With reveries of days gone by, in my solitude, you taunt. With memories
that never die. I sit in my chair, I'm filled with despair. There's no one could be so sad with gloom everywhere. I sit and I stare. I know
That's Tony Bennett singing Duke Ellington's Solitude. Tony Bennett has a new memoir, which is called The Good Life. Did you have personal relationships with a lot of songwriters?
Yes, I did. Harold Arlen was my very favorite. And I never met Yip Harburg, but Harold Arlen told me that Yip Harburg was the best lyric writer that ever lived. And he wrote with everyone, Ira Gershwin. I met Ira Gershwin. He was fantastic. But I had personal relationships with Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen and Jack Siegel, Alan and Marilyn Bergman.
Did anybody write songs especially for you? I know you were often asked to be the first person to record a song.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Mercer wrote I Want to Be Around for me. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting story. You want to tell it?
Well, it's a wonderful story. You know, Sadie Vimmerstadt was a fan in Youngstown, Ohio, and she was an amateur, a songwriter. And she wrote, I Want to Be Around to Pick Up the Pieces When Somebody Breaks Your Heart. She wrote a fan letter to Johnny Mercer. And she said, Johnny, this sounds like something you would write, she said. And so he got such a kick out of it, he wrote the song, finished it, and gave her 50% of the song. And Sadie would send me, after the song was a hit, she would send me cards from all over, from Paris, from Russia, from England. And she'd say, thanks so much, Tony. I think she's the only songwriter that really, really went overboard in thanking me for recording her song. But she took vacations all over the world with the money that she made from that song.
How did Johnny Mercer choose you to record it?
Well, he was living in England there for a while, and so was I, and we just started making a little contact, and then a fella called Phil Zeller, who did his promotion for him and from his music publishing company, told me, Johnny wrote this song and would want you to do it.
Well, let's hear it. This is I Want to Be Around, Tony Bennett.
Be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. But somebody who will swear to be true as you used to do with me, who'll leave you to learn that misery loves company. Wait and see. I mean, I wanna be around
how he does it when he breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine. And that's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet, as I sit there applauding from a front row seat. When somebody breaks your heart like you,
we'll talk more with Tony Bennett after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tony Bennett. He has a new autobiography called The Good Life. You know, it's funny. There was a period in your life when, after Clive Davis became the president of Columbia Records, when you were asked to do a lot of cover songs of the rock and pop hits of the day. And you often didn't like those songs and didn't feel they were appropriate for you. The idea was to get you to sell to younger audiences. You did your best to always just do songs that you loved, and it's interesting now. You've developed a following on the part of younger people who listen to rock and roll. And you did your MTV Unplugged show, and the record and the show were a tremendous hit. I'm interested in how you kind of got connected that way, and what role perhaps your son Danny, who's been managing your career, played in maybe bridging the gap between the generations.
Well, Danny came up to me one day and said, you know, that my songs are starting to connect with people his age. I said, you're kidding. So he put me on SCTV up in Toronto with John Candy, and then...
I remember that. You did the Fish and Magician. Not the Fish and Magician. What was it called? The Fish and...
I forget now.
Yeah, well, you went fishing with him, and your head blew up. Well, why don't we hear something from the Unplugged CD, and this is It Had to Be You.
Thank you.
It seems like dreams, like I've always had, could be, should be, making me glad. Why am I blue? It's up to you to explain. I'm thinking maybe, baby, I'll go away. Someday, someway, maybe you'll come and say, it's you that I need, and you'll be pleading in vain. It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true. Make me be blue. And
even be glad just to be sad thinking of you. Some others I've seen might never be mean.
That's Tony Bennett from his Unplugged CD, and he has a new memoir called The Good Life. You know, we were talking before about composers that you've known, and I'm wondering if any composers have given you a deeper understanding of a song that you sang by kind of talking to you about the song or by singing a line of it for you, emphasizing a certain word.
Well, yes. Harold Arlen told me to always exaggerate, you know, and change it any way you want to. He said, my songs are nothing but a tool to perform with. He said, whatever you want to do with a song, just do it. He said, just exaggerate it. And, you know, instead of saying, don't know why there's no, say, don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, you know, just dramatize it. And, but that's the smallest part of it. The best example is Ernie Harburg. He wrote a book called Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz? And he explained that his father said the way to detect a good song, to find a good song, is if the music hits you emotionally and the words hit you intellectually, he said, it's almost positive that you have a very good song.
Shall we end with a Harold Arlen song?
I'd love it.
Tony Bennett, it's just been a delight to speak with you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Tony Bennett's new autobiography is called The Good Life.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love.
Our program was produced today by Roberta Chirac and Danny Miller. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Thanks to our digital editing coach, Peter Clowney. I'm Terry Gross. Have a great holiday.
I can make the rain go anytime I move my little finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Levenger, tools for serious readers, online at levenger.com, and Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.